Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with armed militia groups heading for the southern border, which is already militarized with active duty and National Guard troops along with Border Patrol, and speak with Michelle Garcia, a journalist and former Texas correspondent for the Columbia Journalism Review and a former columnist for the Texas Observer. She joins us to discuss her new three-part essay series on the border at the Baffler and concerns that heavily armed, untrained militia groups like the Texas Minutemen are responding to President Trump's fear-mongering against destitute migrants he calls invaders, with their website warning of a, quote, large number of criminals crossing the border and that several U.S. law enforcement officers and civilians have been murdered by international bandits in these areas. It also warns militia members that the mainstream media, quote, are not your friends. They work for their globalist open border $sponsors, and already, according to planning documents from U.S. Army commanders leading the 5,200 troops Trump has dispatched to the border, 200 unregulated armed militia members are operating along the southwest border. Then on this day before an election, we will speak with Andrew Gumbel, an award-winning investigative journalist and author of Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. He joins us to discuss a recent poll which found 46% of the American electorate do not believe their votes will be counted fairly, with a third thinking it's likely a foreign country will tamper with the vote. Nevertheless, with partisan enthusiasm and energy surging and an increased turnout expected on both sides, we'll focus on the close and controversial race for governor in Georgia. And since more and more races are decided by narrow margins, the need to have transparent and auditable voting systems is increasingly clear, along with undeniable evidence that the Republican Party no longer believes in democracy and the free and fair exercise of the vote. Then finally, as a reimposition of sanctions against Iran goes into effect today aimed at crippling their economy by driving away customers for Iran's oil, the country's main source of revenue, we will speak with Nada Hashemi, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Denver and author of Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. He joins us to discuss Iran's already shaky economy with their currency in freefall and the young and women taking to the streets to protest soaring prices and massive subsidies to support Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Assad dictatorship in Syria. We'll assess whether Iran's main customers, China, India, and Turkey, will bend under U.S. pressure, and we'll expose the hypocrisy of the tough guy Trump cynically giving Japan, South Korea, and others a grace period to cut back on their imports of Iranian oil because a sudden cutoff would bring about a spike in oil prices, raising prices at the pump just ahead of a critical election. And joining us now is Michelle Garcia, a journalist, essayist, and current Soros Equality Fellow at the Open Society Foundation, a former Texas correspondent for the Columbia Journalism Review and a former columnist for the Texas Observer. She is the director of the PBS documentary Against Mexico, The Making of Heroes and Enemies, and is currently working on a book about borders and their powerful influence on U.S. identity, politics, and culture of violence. She has a new three-part essay series on the border at the Baffler. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michelle Garcia.
Thank you for having me.
And what are we to make of these Minutemen, heavily armed militias, heading to the border? There's quite a few heading down there. Apparently, according to the U.S. Army, commanders of the 5,200 troops that Trump has already dispatched, there are about 200 militia operating on the southwest border. Apparently, they dug in along the border with their arms and camouflage. Some of them have been stealing equipment from the National Guard. But in general, given the militarization of the border already with active duty troops and National Guard, along with the Border Patrol, this seems like a fairly incendiary mix.
Well, absolutely. And I think there's two ways to look at it. One is that this is a somewhat of a performance in the sense that this crisis has been manufactured, right? Because the so-called threat is 1,000 miles away and consists of children and families. So in response to that, we now have the U.S. military on the border, unfurling wiring along the border. And really, their presence, if we understand it in terms of moving away from this immigration debate and this performance, is a yet another instance of law enforcement, police, state presence in a region that has been dominated, as you said, by layers of military and other groups in the name of border security. This also happens, as we all know, right before the midterm election in an area that is predominantly Democratic, and who, if the voters in the area were to turn out in large numbers, could have a powerful effect, significant effect, on the outcome of this election, and therefore changing the political landscape of Texas. So as we're talking about what is happening in regard to the military, in regard to these militias, there are two ways to look at it. One is this performance, this let's go out and defend the border of what is perceived to be a threat on the other side of the river. But there is another way to look at it, which is to look at it within the culture and the history of violent oppression and suppression of votes in South Texas, and that the effect of this is not so much on who may be arriving from south of the border, but the people who already live in Texas. And if we look at these quote-unquote militias, it's reminiscent, if you will, of a century ago when you had the Texas Rangers and vigilantes exercising strong-arm tactics to control and suppress a populace. So the difficulty here is distinguishing between what are we talking about? Are we talking about people who are participating in this crisis, manufactured crisis, and this performance? And it's also very real effects, not on the people who may be arriving, but on the people who already live in Texas.
And there's, of course, a history, and I don't know whether it's still the case today, that Latinos are still referred to as Mexicans, even though they've lived in America for generations, and white Texans, of course, are referred to as whites. Is that still the case?
Well, whites in Texas are often generally referred to as Anglos. Mm-hmm. And Latinos, and I've been having grown up in South Texas, we often refer to ourselves as Mexicans, and then there'll be the distinction. You mean Mexican from here or Mexican from Mexico? I mean, this is very telling. When the vocabulary that we have in place is part of the legacy of a national, in lieu of a racial category, we have these national origin categories, right? I mean, clearly not all whites are Anglos. Right. But this is how this racial construct was created in Texas. And part of what's tricky is, and this has been going on now for decades, is that immigration, citizenship status, and so forth has been used as a proxy for race. And this obviously is intensifying in Texas and elsewhere. It has also been, and as I wrote in the series, it's easy to sort of skirt racial third rails, if you will, when you're talking about citizenship or immigration. But underneath that, the construction of these so-called debates is one about race. It has always been in regard to Latinos. And what is interesting and important to remember, and this goes back to your initial question about the militias, is that when people say, well, there is this backlash against, there's this nativist movement, or there's this anti-immigration sentiment. Well, that does not take into, and that has existed now for generations in the United States, does not take into account one simple fact that makes this different, which is the United States did not obtain half its land territory and define its borders, and in many ways a culture and identity, fighting Irish, or Italians or Poles. It did it fighting Mexicans. And that created a culture, a history, and an identity that we're still grappling with, and that often goes unchecked and unacknowledged. And it created a sense of, it informed the national identity, and we are seeing that legacy played out now, just as we did in 2016, when our current president put together a base and a campaign built on the most simplistic, easily recognizable phrases, which is build that wall, and a mantra about Mexicans
being rapists and murderers. Now, obviously, Donald Trump is just absolutely unleashed at the moment, full-on racist, basically saying the brown people are coming to invade you and take away your jobs and the yellow people are screwing you. That's a shorthand of his message at the moment. But it's such an interesting contrast, is it not? And you've written about this in your piece, Beto at the Border. Beto O'Rourke, of course, has pointed out the opposite, which is, in spite of all of this drumbeat of warning of impending violence and invasions on the border, Beto O'Rourke's constituency in El Paso happens to be the least violent, the most peaceful part of the United States with the lowest crime rate.
Right, and that has been the case for years, including at the height of Felipe Calderon, former Mexican president's so-called Guerra contra el Narco, the drug war. And I have to admit, this took a while for me to recognize what was going on in Beto O'Rourke's campaign, because I was in Texas until very recently, and was there when he was launching his campaign and was coming through Austin and San Antonio. And what finally I began to sort of focus on was the way in which he is, and his campaign has been directly and indirectly re-narrating the border. And this is so important to understand, because I have been covering border issues for years, and we have these arguments and debates, and we bring out these statistics about crime rates and, oh, do immigrants contribute to crime, which obviously report after report after report shows they don't. And yet it seems to make little to no difference. And part of the reason for this is because the border itself has had such a powerful influence in this country and the narrative about the border. And what Beto O'Rourke has done is he has positioned himself within a growing movement of artists and activists and local residents of the border who have been, through various means and ways, communicating another message about the border. And I'll be the first to admit, too, that I, as a journalist, have traveled to the border during my career to practice some sort of, you know, cowboy journalism of the danger and violence and so forth of the border, while overlooking its complexity and nuance. And unbeknownst to me, also contributing to that narrative, we have a deeply entrenched one single story about the border. What Beto O'Rourke has been doing is saying the border is a reflection of who we are as a nation. And so how we talk about the border, how we project violence onto it, the way that in the face of families arriving at the border, military and troopers are sent out rather than humanitarian aid workers, this is a reflection of who the United States is. And that's what Beto O'Rourke has been saying. And this is so powerful, because until that story is changed, until that story is examined about what the border is and its powerful influence in this country, we can have these ongoing arguments and debates about facts and figures, and it does not change anything, because what we're really truly discussing here is the soul of this country and who we are as a nation, who we want to be.
Well, just in closing, in the last minute, Michelle Garcia, fear is a more powerful emotion than reason, unfortunately. Who's going to win in terms of the fearmonger Trump and the peacemaker Beto?
Well, I think that who has won already are the voters of Texas and the people of the United States, because the conversation that you and I are having right now, we weren't having 5 years ago or 10 years ago. We weren't having it 20 years ago. We've already won because we're already having other conversations that are not defined by people in power. We are opening the narratives and having discussions that are way beyond narrowly defined political stories that govern our lives. We won. That's who won.
Well, Michelle Garcia, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Michelle Garcia, who's a journalist, essayist, and current Soros Equality Fellow at the Open Society Foundation, a former Texas correspondent for the Columbia Journalism Review, and a former columnist for the Texas Observer. She is the director of the PBS documentary Against Mexico, The Making of Heroes and Enemies, and is currently working on a book about borders and their powerful influence on U.S. identity, politics, and the culture of violence. And she has a new 3-part essay series on the border at The Buffalo. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the need for transparent and auditable voting systems and the undeniable evidence that the Republican Party no longer believes in democracy and the free and fair exercise of the vote. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Andrew Gumbel, who's worked as an award-winning investigative reporter, a political columnist, and a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, The Independent, Los Angeles Times, The Nation, and The Atlantic. And he's the author of several books, including Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed, and Why It Still Matters. And his latest book is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Gumbel.
Thank you so much.
And the rotten history of elections in the United States is now, I think, getting the attention of many people in this country, particularly as they focus on the races in Georgia and Kansas, both situations where you have the Secretary of State also running for governor, which is unprecedented in all other countries. But we do have, obviously, a screwed-up election system in this country that is run by partisans as opposed to by independents. That's a subject we've spoken about before. But with the focus now on Georgia, let's go back to some work that you did on covering what happened in Georgia with the early by-election that took place early in the Trump administration that was seen as a watershed, John Ossoff running against Karen Handel. My understanding is that you uncovered evidence that Brian Kemp, the Secretary of State, now running for governor, altered the results so that Ossoff wouldn't get to the 50% threshold to avoid a runoff?
I think that would be overstating things. I think what is true is we have a lot of unanswered questions about how the count went on the night of that election and why there were variations before and after a machine breakdown that have not been adequately explained. But this is part of a bigger picture of, you know, lack of any kind of accountability within the system that would pass muster with basic computer security experts, and also a shocking lack of separation of power, for want of a better term, between the Secretary of State's office and partisans of the Republican Party and the electoral machinery that runs elections in the state. And, you know, Brian Kemp is somebody who has come under fire on many fronts, and this is just one of them. One of the upshots of the legislation that was triggered by the events that you refer to is that the university that used to be the keeper of the software of the state voting system, Kennesaw State University, lost that role because of public embarrassment, and Brian Kemp, the Secretary of State, chose to take over that responsibility himself. So, you know, unlike the other close elections around the country, and, you know, unlike Kris Kobach in Kansas, for example, you have this unique situation not only that the person who's in charge of running the election and counting the votes is himself a candidate, but also, in the case of Georgia, that he has complete control over the election machinery, the software, et cetera, that runs machines, all of which is out of date, unreliable, and, you know, subject to all kinds of problems that we may never know about because it is completely inauditable. One fact that I was reminded of just the other day is that Georgia's machines were purchased in 2002. They were inadequate then. But the company that produced them got out of the election business in 2009. So there has been no mechanism for servicing the machines for the last 9 years. And in fact, when the state of Georgia needs replacement parts for its touchscreen voting machines, it has to go on eBay to find them. You know, that I think tells you more than anything what kind of a terrible state the machines are in. And it's something that's been politically wished for to the extent that a poorly run electoral system that has little accountability, little auditability, little transparency is something that has served the agenda of Brian Kemp and the Republican Party over the last several years that he's been in charge. They've been able to enact a number of strict rules about kicking people off the electoral rolls if they don't vote in an election, for example, questioning people's eligibility for a variety of reasons, most recently this notorious exact match requirement that the registration documents have to match everything else that is in the government's possession. So if there is a hyphen different from a driver's license to an application, or if somebody's name has changed because of marriage or another reason, that can be a reason to stop people from being eligible to vote. And that you know, all these things have occurred against the backdrop of a system that has never been properly accountable. And that's actually, by the way, a two-party problem in Georgia, because it was the Democrats who introduced this terrible voting machinery in the first place.
And the voting machinery in Georgia, they run their elections on old Windows 2000 machines. They're so old that Microsoft no longer supports the operating system for security updates. And, of course, there's no paper trail, no voter verification, no ability to audit or recount. So this is an extraordinary situation. And is it deliberate? In other words, did Kemp, I think he turned down money, didn't he, from the feds to update the machinery?
I think what would be accurate is to say that there has been an utter disregard for the serious issues that the voting system has presented for the last 16 years. You know, it's all very well saying that Microsoft 2000, Microsoft no longer services the software, you know, but the fact is this was a terrible system even when Microsoft was still servicing the software. So it's a terrible system that has got, you know, several degrees more terrible, I think would be the best way to understand it. Brian Kemp, Secretary of State, has had multiple opportunities to change the system, to make it simpler, to make it cheaper, to make it more accountable, and he has shown an utter lack of interest in doing so. And this is, you know, unfortunately par for the course for a lot of election administrators around the country that are ultimately much more interested in having the appearance of something being well run than having something that is transparent enough that people can actually check and see if that appearance matches reality.
The sad part of all of this, though, Andrew, is that the fact that we have such porous election systems, state controls, complications, having to register, which no other country does that. I mean, it's clear, there's a clear difference between the two parties. Well, Democrats seem to want more people to vote, and the Republicans clearly want less people to vote. But the overall effect of the kind of discussion we're having indicates that a recent poll in this country showed that 46% of the American electorate do not think that their votes will be counted fairly, and about a third think it's likely that a foreign country will tamper with the results. Now, that's pretty alarming, and surely that has an effect. If you don't trust the system, there's already enough apathy. It's that we have the worst statistics in terms of people not showing up to vote. The majority, I think, still doesn't vote in this country. Or at the best of times, I think 60% vote. So I'm sort of reluctant even to cover this subject and the problems we have with our voting simply because I don't want to reinforce the despair that already exists. And I imagine when you wrote your book, you had that in mind as well.
That's certainly true. And I think, you know, what you've seen over the last several years, and it's you know, gone into hyperdrive over the last couple of years since Donald Trump became president, but the issue existed already, which is, you know, a lot of bogus reasons are being offered for people to have little faith in the electoral system. The most notorious one in recent years being this notion that there is an epidemic of in-person voter fraud. In other words, people showing up at the polls pretending to be somebody they're not, or casting a ballot when they're not eligible to cast one. There is absolutely no evidence that this is a problem of any scale that should concern anyone. On the other hand, you do have political manipulation of the system. You have, you know, the existence of rules that make it harder to vote. Listeners may have seen a piece in the New York Times this morning about Tennessee, where it's virtually impossible for college students to vote for a variety of technical reasons that they have deliberately imposed there. And, you know, the Republican Party, after Barack Obama's election in 2008, essentially decided to wage war on two groups of voters, minority voters and students. And you see this repeated over and over around the country. So you have genuine issues that cause people to worry that the results are not correct. And some of them are to do with machinery, but a lot more of them are to do with, you know, misuse of election administration and the discretion of election administrators who happen to be partisans. And I think the answer of how to approach this is very much a data-driven one. You know, that if you can demonstrate that something has a tangible, you know, effect in terms of evidence, then I think it's reasonable for people to look at that and say, you know, this is a real problem we need to address. If it's something based on belief, you know, the belief that illegal immigrants are voting in large numbers, the belief that Democrats want to steal elections for this reason, that reason, or the other reason, you know, that is not a helpful line of argument. And the best way to have data and the best way to have, you know, solid fact is to have more transparency and not less. And I think, you know, if there's any glimmer of hope in the situation we're in, is that if there's a way of separating out ordinary Americans from the political overlords who have manipulated the system, it's this, which is, I think, most Americans, Republican or Democrat, would be in favor of the system that was transparent and accountable. And I think most Americans would also subscribe to the idea that people should have equal access to the ballot if they're eligible voters. You know, there's a lot of room for disagreement in the margins about how you determine some of these things. But I think, you know, we need to get back to first principles and agree that we want to live in a democracy and that we have to construct an architecture that's consistent with that aspiration. And unfortunately, this country has never fully had that. And in the last few years, we've seen things going backwards in dramatic fashion.
But since we are so polarized and since elections more and more are decided by maybe hundreds of votes, if you know, not thousands of votes, or even tens of votes, there have been many, many cases it's been that close. And I suspect, I think you could safely predict that this election tomorrow, there'll be lots and lots of House races where the possibility of the Democrats picking up the House will be, you know, on the line in terms of very, very narrow margins. And this, to my mind, indicates that this is why I think it's so dangerous to have such a porous, such an easily manipulated, such an unregulated kind of patchwork of systems, particularly those in Georgia, where, and I think there are other states that have the same touchscreen machines.
There's a handful. I think roughly 10 to 15% of the country's votes tomorrow will be counted on electronic machines that aren't auditable.
But do you think it's a safe bet, Andrew, that the margins are going to be pretty close? And that
we'll see. I mean, you know, I think what we can say is that a lot of the polls are very close. But I think part of the reason why the polls are close, and if you look at the margins of error, they're very wide compared to polls in the past. You know, 4.5%, 5% percentage point margins of error. And I think the reason for that is the pollsters have to take a guess as to what the electorate is going to look like. And, you know, we don't know. We don't know how many young people are going to vote, who usually stay away from midterm elections completely. We don't know how many registered Republicans in affluent suburban districts are actually going to cast votes for Democratic candidates. You know, there's a lot of things we don't know. So pollsters can, you know, they take a guess how many Republicans are going to show up, how many Democrats are going to show up, how many independents, how many young people, how many old people, et cetera. But it's not until we start getting, you know, the first returns tomorrow night that we'll really know. And, I would actually refine your prediction of a lot of nail-biting the close races and say, you know, I suspect in districts that are similar, you know, in other words, for example, you know, affluent suburbs, we're probably going to see a similar trend across the country. So if the Democrats do well because they get the votes out of the people they need to get out, we're probably going to see them prevail in a lot of those districts. If they don't succeed in doing that, then it might get nail-bitingly close and or they may lose them all. You know, but there are different kinds of districts around the country. You know, the Montana Senate race is a very different, or the North Dakota Senate race is a very different kind of electorate from, say, some of the races in suburban Orange County. Where, you know, in Orange County, Trump is very unpopular for the most part. In Montana and in North Dakota, he's pretty popular, you know, certainly. And you can plausibly win an election by appealing to the Trump strain of the electorate. That's not going to work in Orange County. So, you know, we'll just have to see which groups show up, how effective the campaigns have been, how angry people are, how motivated they are on each side. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of motivation on both sides, certainly. But if it does get close, then we are going to be in a situation where people will start to ask serious questions. You know, did the voter ID restriction shrink the Democratic electorate enough to make what should have been an easy victory a marginal race and or one they're going to lose? And what does that mean for the future of democracy? You know, these questions were raised in 2016. You know, for instance, in Wisconsin, the margin of error, or the margin of victory, I'm sorry, for Trump in Wisconsin was 23,000 votes. And I have seen studies that suggest that the number of votes that were impacted by voter restrictions was as high as 45,000. Now, we don't know if they would have all voted Democrat, probably not. But, you know, it would only take a 60-40 Democratic split of those votes for the election to have gone in a very different direction. So, you know, every time we're going to have these questions until the system can get cleaned up. And, you know, it's not an accident. You know, the Republicans are now a party that rely on an increasingly white, increasingly male electorate. That electorate is essentially a minority in this country. And so rather than grow their brand and try and appeal to more voters, they have chosen to try and restrict access and interest in voting and to try and eke out majorities that way. And it's a very dangerous path to go down. I do believe that it will fail in the long term, but tremendous amount of damage can be done in the short term while that kind of dangerous political gamesmanship goes on.
Well, it's certainly going on in North Dakota, and Heidi Heitkamp won 6 years ago by, I think, a little more than 1,000 votes, and she won because of the Native American vote. And that is being suppressed in a rather flagrant way by the state legislature, who passed a special law forcing the Indian reservations who have post office boxes as opposed to street addresses, disqualifying anybody with a post office box. And now I believe they're scrambling to try and give themselves street addresses. But again, that is so flagrant. And also, it's extraordinary to think that the Supreme Court upheld that obvious, flagrant example of voter suppression.
Right. Well, I mean, one thing that's changed is, you know, one thing you saw in the year, so 2013, the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act and took away the Justice Department's power to pre-clear election-related laws in areas of the country that had a history of racial discrimination. That meant that if you wanted to challenge what a state or jurisdiction was doing, you had to go to court, which obviously takes several years to go to complete. And things were looking pretty good, actually. You know, North Carolina's voting system was struck down by the federal courts. Texas's voter ID law was struck down by the federal courts. And the expectation was, pre the Trump presidency, that the Supreme Court would not stand in the way of those federal court decisions. Now you have, you know, two new justices on the Supreme Court who are known to be conservatives. In the case of Brett Kavanaugh in particular, has a reputation of being, you know, a political partisan. And this is really problematic. We don't know how they're going to rule, but there is now genuine concern that, you know, nobody can count on the courts anymore to redress the injustice that has been manifest in many different places around the country. And that is something that, you know, is a very sinister development, because if, you know, ultimately, if the final authority in the country is willing to countenance an electoral system that is not fair, that is not transparent and that penalizes groups of voters for partisan reasons, we're no longer living in a democracy at that point.
Well, just in closing, I'm going to ask you the difficult question, Andrew. Why don't millennials vote and why don't Latinos vote after this president has insulted them in such a flagrant and disgusting way by calling them a bunch of murderers and rapists and ripping Latino children from their parents at the southern border?
Well, I think one reason why people are turned off voting is because of disgust at the system. And, you know, there is plenty of partisan rancor and animosity and name-calling and a general sort of devaluation of the whole project of public discourse and the conduct of public life, which I think is very off-putting to large numbers of voters, not just young people. But I think there is a sense, you know, among young people, certainly I've spoken to, that their vote doesn't count or that the system is rotten and there's nothing to be done about it. That kind of, you know, defeatist thinking, which is only exacerbated by the negative campaigning, the racist ads. And in the other direction, frankly, you know, plenty of negative mud being thrown from left to right as well. Latinos, I think, you know, I think it's hard to generalize. Because you have Latinos of different class status, different educational status. You know, Latinos in Texas are a different proposition from Latinos, say, in California or in Florida. But one thing I have noticed in the campaigns I've covered here in Southern California is there is a reluctance by the Democratic Party and by specific candidates to court the Latino vote in any kind of energetic manner. And, you know, you can look for a number of reasons for that. One might be simply taking the Latino vote for granted, but, you know, we've seen that the level of participation has been pretty dismal and has not been increasing over the last election cycles. I think there's a specific problem this time for the candidates in the swing districts that the Democrats hope to pick up, which is, I think, immigration is a lightning rod issue. And I think the perception of the candidates is, if I'm too open in my embrace of the Latino community, that will turn off voters who are more conservative, might in the past have voted for Republican, who I need to win the race, and so I can't be too visible in my embrace of Latinos. Which is, you know, it's a crazy logic because Latinos and immigration are not synonymous. You know, Latinos are American citizens like everybody else. They have issues of all different kinds. But I think that is the reality. I've seen a really kind of stagnant, if not self-defeating, strategy in certain districts in Orange County, for example, in terms of courting the Latino vote. And, you know, I think the story on Wednesday morning, if Holly Ritter doesn't beat Dana Rohrabacher, or if
Devin Nunes, Mike Levin, Devin Nunes.
You know, I think the reason will be in part because the Latino vote was not courted adequately.
Sure.
But, you know, we'll see.
Well, Andrew Gumbel, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Gumbel, who's worked as an award-winning investigative reporter, a political columnist, and a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, The Independent, Los Angeles Times, The Nation, and The Atlantic. He's the author of several books, including Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Still Matters. And his latest book is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the reimposition of sanctions against Iran, which go into effect today, aimed at crippling their economy by driving away customers for Iran's oil.
I've been waiting for years to buy a brand new Cadillac, but now that I've got one, gotta send it right back. I can't afford that gas from a brand new limousine.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Nada Hashemi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. And his latest book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashemi.
Thank you, Ian.
And today, the reimposition of sanctions against Iran that were lifted under the 2015 nuclear deal have gone into effect. Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, has rather defiantly said, we will proudly break the sanctions. But there's no question that these sanctions are going to have a terrible impact on a country that's already reeling with the currency in free fall, prices going through the roof, women taking to the streets, chafing against the strictures of the rule by the mullahs, etc. It does feel as if Iran is ready for some kind of social explosion. What's your feeling on this?
Well, yes. I mean, the domestic discontent is very deep. It's vast. It goes into large sections of the population, particularly young people, students, the middle class. We're approaching the 40th year of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, and it broadly, I think, has been a failure in terms of, you know, meeting the demands and hopes and expectations of the of large swaths of the Iranian society. You know, I could go into detail, but I don't think that these sanctions that Trump and Bolton are imposing on Iran are going to produce the type of revolution that they hope, for two main reasons. Number one, I think there is no appetite for a violent revolution in Iran. There is a broad, I think, consensus that despite the difficult internal economic conditions, the repression of the regime, that there's no appetite for another bloody revolution. Iranians have experienced a lot of blood and repression. So there's a demand for political change, but there's also a demand for peaceful political change, not violent revolution. And secondly, the regional environment, you know, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Syria, and farther afar in Libya has produced, I think, a set of lessons for Iranians that they don't want to turn their country into a failed and collapsed state like those countries that I just listed. So I think Bolton and Trump are dreaming big dreams that these punitive sanctions, which are going to take a huge toll on the people of the Islamic Republic of Iran, not the regime, that these are going to lead to some sort of regime change and an expansion of American influence in the region.
Well, clearly there is a compact of sorts between Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the United States in putting the squeeze on Iran. It's not just the United States, and we don't know the extent to which the tail is wagging the dog, since this administration seems to be so deferential, not just to Vladimir Putin, but also to Benjamin Netanyahu. But the really scandalous and obvious fact is that Trump and Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, have thrown their lot in with MBS, this disgraced thug, murderous little kleptocrat and autocrat, who they joined in this public relations campaign to suggest that he was some kind of great reformer. That is all blown up in their face, but they're doubling down, the Trump-Kushner crowd. They're even more in support of MBS, and I'm sure a lot of money has changed hands. So that seems to be what's driving it, as far as I can see. And it's just extraordinary. Not that the regime under Khamenei and the Revolutionary Guard Corps are not an odious group of kleptocrats themselves, but by comparison, we're really backing the wrong side here in terms of throwing our lot in with this murderous little dictator with absolute impunity, who's shown that he has absolute impunity and no regard for human rights, and yet he's our champion in the Middle East. He's the horse we're backing.
No, I would agree with that broad characterization, Ian. I would just add that I'm uncomfortable with the phrase, we're backing the wrong side. I think, as you just outlined, both sides are odious, both sides are repressive, and both sides are, you know, poor options that we should be struggling against. I do agree that the odious, you know, coalition of MBS, the Saudi Crown Prince, Netanyahu, the Emirates, General El-Sisi in Egypt, etc., is a much more, a much more disgusting group of characters who have sowed a lot of mayhem in the region. But I don't think the correct response is to try and somehow diminish our critique of the internal repression that the Islamic Republic of Iran has imposed on its people for the last 40 years. I think we should be able to, operate on multiple tracks. And so I see this as a sort of an opportunity for people who are very interested and concerned about moving the Middle East in a better direction to really shine a spotlight on some of these members of this coalition that Saudi Arabia, Kushner, and Benjamin Netanyahu have put together to highlight what they are doing in the region and how it's really catastrophic. It's not just their policy on Iran, which I think is going to fundamentally just, disenfranchise and hurt the average Iranian citizen while not really affecting the regime, but it's in, just the broader regional landscape, which is on the verge of another explosion because of this deepening stranglehold of authoritarianism that is suffocating the region, and unfortunately is being backed primarily by the United States under Donald Trump, but also the Europeans. And this is also a story that I would highlight. It cannot be all laid at the doorstep of Donald Trump. I mean, the Obama administration and previous administrations basically supported the regional authoritarian order with very few, changes in policies. So, we're looking at a very dim and very sort of grim Middle East today with very few prospects for optimism in the near future. And that's just the reality we have to deal with.
So back to the sanctions. Obviously, the real tool here is the Brussels-based SWIFT network, which is necessary to make international payments and payments for oil. And the main customers, of course, for Iran's oil are China, then followed by India, South Korea, Turkey, Italy, France, Japan, and the UAE. And while the United States wouldn't have much influence over China, some over India, and some over Turkey, but obviously has a lot of influence over South Korea, Italy, France, and Japan. But it turns out that the Trump administration has given them all a grace period before the sanctions are imposed, with the exception, of course, of the Europeans. And this is clearly designed to make sure that the price of oil doesn't go up before the elections. So I see a very cynical ploy there on the part of the Trump administration. He says he wants maximum sanctions, but when he rolls them out, they really do have a major caveat.
That's a great point, Ian, and I think it just highlights the incoherence of this policy that Trump and Pompeo and Bolton are pursuing with respect to Iran. The fact that they've given exemptions to these eight countries, undermines their desire to really affect Iran's oil exports. Under Obama, there was a comprehensive sanctions regime that had buy-in from the entire international community over Iran's nuclear program. And those sanctions were very effective precisely because they were international and they were focused on bringing Iran to the negotiating table. These ones that we're seeing right now have a lot of holes, a lot of exemptions, and it's seriously in doubt whether they're going to really bring about the desired goals that the Trump administration is articulating in terms of trying to change Iran's regional behavior. I think what my own reading of this is, a lot of this is simply driven by a narrow ideological group of actors, both in Washington and in the region, who simply want to punish Iran without any serious plan to change Iran's behavior. And so, I would draw your listeners' attention to a very important, report that came out last week by the International Crisis Group called The Illogic of U.S. Sanctions Snapback on Iran, where they looked at the last 40 years of sanctions on Iran, and they said that it's very difficult to find a correlation between Iran's economic performance and sanctions that are placed on Iran's economy and its regional policy, that the nature of Iran's regional role is a low-intensity warfare. It doesn't invest a lot of money. And despite sanctioning the regime does have a lot of, resources, has a lot of, international bank deposits, ways of getting around sanctions that can still facilitate its regional policy. And so That report is quite detailed. It's by a respected independent, you know, group that monitors, you know, questions of conflict around the world, and it casts, I think, a very sort of dark shadow over this plan that the Trump administration is pursuing. And I think at the end of the day, the tragedy will be that it'll be, you know, as I said earlier, the Iranian people who have no say over their government's regional policy, over their government's internal repression, who will pay the big price here because of the deep ideological, you know, zealotry that we're seeing in the White House today.
But now, Hashimi, when you talk about ideological zealotry, you could also be describing the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, and the Revolutionary Guard Corps and the Pashtun Basij Militia, etc. They're the ones that keep the Iranian people in line, and they're going to be busy more and more as more and more young Iranians and particularly women take to the streets. And one of the things that chafes the average Iranian is that how much money Iran is spending on Hezbollah and supporting Syria's dictator Bashar al-Assad. The State Department says that since 2012, Iran has spent $16 billion supporting Hezbollah and Bashar al-Assad. So, and of course, talking about ideologues, I mean, one of the problems with the Iranian regime is that they don't seem to care about international law and norms. They go and assassinate their enemies wherever they can find them. And there was recently an arrest made in Denmark of an Iranian hit team out to kill an Iranian dissident. So does the leadership get the message that this is one of the reasons why they're incredibly unpopular?
No, they don't get the message, largely because authoritarian regimes tend to, and particularly leaders of authoritarian regimes, tend to live in their own bubble. You're absolutely correct that the leadership of the Islamic Republic does have its own ideological zealotry that I think drives a lot of its policies. And I think it's simply trying to quite, with a lot of sophistication, you know, spin an internal narrative that is really rooted in themes of Iranian nationalism, that Iran is being subjected to external aggression by imperial powers, and trying to rally as many people as it can around the flag of Iranian nationalism in response to Trump's new aggressive policy. Now, that's an argument that no longer, I think, is believable by many Iranians. But like all authoritarian regimes, you don't need majority support. You just need a minority group of people who are willing to come into the streets when you call on them. And then, of course, you need the heavy hand of repression to keep everyone else in line. And then you need enough financial resources to pay off your loyalists. And the Islamic Republic, despite these sanctions that are being posed on it, still has those, you know, resources at its disposal, which is one reason why I'm so critical of Trump's foreign policy, because I think it's doing the exact opposite of its stated intent to try and allegedly help the Iranian people bring about political change. I mean, if that was the goal, I think the Obama administration's plan of economic engagement, of decreasing tensions, trying to strengthen the middle class, trying to embolden precisely those people who were at the core of the 2009 Green Movement protests and who brought the regime really to a breaking point almost, that's the better way forward, not by impoverishing, sanctioning, and pursuing these types of policies, which ironically actually don't really affect the upper echelons of the regime. They have, you know, sufficient patron clientele networks, smuggling networks, foreign bank reserves to sustain themselves. So I think ultimately at the end of the day, it's just going to be counterproductive. And, you know, ironically, I think the biggest beneficiaries of the current Trump policy is going to be the hardliners who control the Islamic Republic.
And that's, of course, pretty much what Trump did with Cuba. I mean, you know, by cutting off ties that were developed under Obama, brokered by Pope Francis, the hardliners are back in even more control. The people have sort of in more despair, and they're suffering more. I just don't understand what motivates people like Bolton, except I think in Bolton's case and in Trump's case, they're kind of bitter about the fact, particularly Bolton, that he's sort of so much on the fringe of the foreign policy elite that he's got something to prove. I don't know. What do you think motivates this guy? Because he's so boneheaded. Ideologues are so ridiculous in foreign policy because they're so predictable. You can play them like a violin.
Yeah. What? You know, that's a good question. I think you really need a clinically trained psychiatrist to really answer your question comprehensively. But my own view is that Part of it has to do with simply trying to distinguish themselves, the Trump administration, from what Obama was doing. So, you know, tearing up the Iran nuclear accord does that. But I think a lot of the motivation, this applies less to Bolton, but more to, I think, Trump and his inner circle. You know, as we see domestically, they really want to cater to their core base of supporters in the country. And so by pursuing these, you know, cosmetic, seemingly bold and aggressive, you know, positions that really are about posturing, not about really bringing about any results, they accomplish that quite significantly. There's no serious, you know, long-term, I think, calculation of, you know, how to, you know, advance a serious policy agenda, working multilaterally and thinking through the different sort of aspects of a plan. It's really short-term. It's for immediate sort of, you know, headlines. It's the posture. It's to sort of, you know, cater to your base, distinguish yourselves from, you know, the previous administration, and that's it. So I think that's really the policy here. It's really responding to these narrow lobby groups, of which it's not just, you know, catering to the base support in the Republican Party, but also it's really the influential, you know, voices and actors in the D.C., Washington, D.C. lobby circuit who are on the payroll of different Gulf states, who are deeply indebted to and are closely connected with, you know, the passionate supporters of Benjamin Netanyahu in Washington, i.e. AIPAC, who are pushing a lot of this agenda, simply, I think, for very narrow short-term calculations, but nothing long-term. And I think the Cuba analogy that you pointed to is actually a very apt comparison.
Well, just in closing, I think this administration, a more accurate way to look at them is they are completely pay-to-play. This is a mercenary, mercantile, corrupt group of people. They come out of Trump's record is so shady, it's beyond belief, with Russian money laundering and mobbed-up connections, etc. We could spend the rest of the day talking about that. But the pay-to-play aspect seems so clear here. The Saudis, MBS and Jared Kushner made some kind of financial deal. There's all kinds of people looking into it. And we know that Sheldon Adelson was one of the biggest donors, if not the biggest donor, to Donald Trump, and he's getting his payback. Isn't that a big part of it? Just to simply, you know, that if you give Trump money and adoration, you own him.
No, I totally agree. I think it's completely transactional. With Trump itself, it's pretty clear that it's ego-driven, that he doesn't have any, I think, particular commitment to any sort of values or vision beyond his own personal sort of reputation, which is why he sort of really loved the summit with the North Korean dictator, because it got him a lot of media attention. He sort of hinted, I don't know if you recall, Ian, but in the context of Iran, he sort of hinted at the in September at the UN General Assembly meetings of the heads of state that if Rouhani, he called him a good guy, wanted to reach out to him, he would be open to such a meeting, I think really driven by just the positive press coverage. And then, of course, the underlying economic corruption with all of these oligarchs and, you know, corrupt, you know, players in the international business scene really solidifies Trump's, you know, I think, you know, his political base and how he thinks about politics. There's nothing here that's in the interest of the American people, of international peace and security, of more stability in the Middle East. I think when history is written about this period, Ian, I think this is going to be one of the darkest days, not just in terms of American domestic politics, but in terms of U.S. foreign policy as well.
Well, Nader Hashemi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Nader Hashemi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. And his latest book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.